Log Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your hosts, Luke Jim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Hello, everyone. Once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, your daily anarchist radio show on the internet, with your hosts, Charnchi, also known as Chomskian, and Mr. 1001 Nights. And so we have a pretty special night tonight, right, Chomskian?
Yeah, we have a special guest, Paul Street, who writes for a lot of different places, but mostly on Z Magazine, Znet.
Yeah, you know, I have to say that up till very recently, I wasn't really aware of his work. That I was struck by the accuracy of his analysis of the Obama administration. I don't think there's many thinkers out there that you know offer a real articulate radical critique of the Obama administration, and he's certainly one of them, one of the sharper ones. And that's precisely why we wanted to have him on the show, because the Obama administration has obviously captured the imagination and the fantasies of a lot of Americans who hoped that a lot of the progressive policies they wanted to see implemented would be realized. But unfortunately, it hasn't happened, and that has to do with some of the facts that Paul Street talks about in his book. You've read the book, haven't you, Charnchi?
I've read parts of it, and actually, I started reading his articles on Znet in the run up to the primaries, you know, the Democratic primaries, and it's just like so dead on that I just continue on with him. And when he released his book, was before the election itself, but he basically predicted it, and. Yeah, it's very much on point, and he writes from a left libertarian perspective, which is very rare, and it's kind of unfortunate that it's not very popular out in the mainstream, you know, this point of view.
And right.
Should be much more in the mainstream analysis, you know.
Yeah, in fact, just a few days back, I read an article about the war in Afghanistan, and he very methodically went through all of the reasons why the war is illegal, why it's not moral, why all of the things that Obama said were not true. And I have to say that I really hadn't heard anyone, you know, but Chomsky and maybe Edward Herman and a few other people talk about the illegality of the war in such a meticulous manner. So I was pretty impressed, and so I guess I'm going to introduce him, and you know, he said he was going to call in the next few minutes. So as I do that, I also want to remind listeners that in the second half of the show, we're going to take your questions, and Paul Street will take your questions. So you can call, and the number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. And I'm sure that if you want to call, if you want to ask questions in the chat room, Charnchi will very gladly communicate those questions to Paul. So he hasn't called
and
in yet.
And also, I just posted the links to his V space site, and also a link to his book about the Obama rise, and also about, you know, it's actually it's a book about American politics in general, but you know, using the Obama context. So those links are up in the chat room.
Right, and so. Yeah, he's actually the author of four books, and he is an independent journalist, a historian, a policy researcher from Chicago, and he's now living in Iowa City. And his four books are Empire and Inequality, America and the World Since 9/11, Segregated Schools, Educational Apartheid in the Post-Civil Rights Era, racial oppression in the global metropolis, living black Chicago history. And most recently, the book that we were talking about is Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics. And as Chanchi mentioned, he has written numerous articles for many publications, most regularly on Znet and Z Magazine. Yeah, so, and yeah, I guess that one of the questions that we were trying to tackle with was, you know, there's an older generation of activists, an older generation of intellectual, radical intellectuals. And, you know, we have big shoes to fill in, right? People like Chomsky, Howard Zinn, they're getting older. So there's every generation has a new wave of intellectuals. And I would say that Paul Street is one of them. And so we have him on the line. And we are very glad to have him tonight. So let's see if he is there. Paul, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Hey,
am I
Paul.
Talking now to John or Chomsky?
Oh, this is Jonathan.
Okay, Jonathan.
Yeah, so yeah, we're very glad to have you here, and I guess we'll just get started with the questions. So the question number one is, first of all, why did you decide to chronicle Obama's rise? What do you think can be gained by paying so much attention to a political personality?
I found out recently that you could bet in Las Vegas over who the next president was. I should have put $1,000 down on Obama in 06. I had him picked, wouldn't normally write as much as I had about one candidate or one office holder. It's contrary to my intellectual background, and a matter of fact, it focused as much as I did on sort of biographical material. But I had a feeling really from Obama's keynote address, actually in Boston in July of 2004, on that I was very possibly looking at a particular type of politician who was likely to be a president quite soon. In fact, as after Kerry lost, it struck me that maybe in 2008. And I was Obama had a capacity, I thought, to give the American empire, and in fact the American corporate system, and of course both of those are combined and interrelated phenomena, a public relations makeover that none of the other presidential candidates could do. There was and they clearly were going to need a very significant type of rebranding, a makeover. It's often inside the power elite. It's often described very much in those sorts of terms. A kind of makeover that I didn't think that Hillary Clinton could provide, or that John Edwards could provide. Obviously, that John McCain could have ever provided. I sort of thought he was their man. So I thought he was important, and I thought he was important from early on, much sooner than a lot of other people did. There were a few others who sort of caught a whiff of this and thought the same kind of way, including a lot of people on the black left, like Glenn Ford and Bruce Dixon at Black Agenda Report, and Michael Haru in Seattle, who writes every once in a while for Black Agenda Report. And the other thing is that I was in a unique situation, I think, to write about Obama. A, I knew him from Chicago. For many years, I had this kind of mainstream job inside the so-called civil rights movement. Sometimes I call it the post-civil rights movement. I was research director at the Chicago Urban League, and this involved lobbying, among other things, lobbying legislators and holding public events, and oftentimes this sort of carrot. There was an Illinois Obama phenomenon before there was a national Obama phenomenon. You knew Obama if you were in around the circles I was around, and had a pretty good sense of him and his own propensities, and actually his conservatism and his subordination to and his involvement in concentrated power. Obama, contrary to what a lot of people wanted to think in where I live right now, which is Iowa, you know, Obama was always kind of a corporate neoliberal centrist. I mean, probably a militarist, but you don't know much about that when someone is in a state legislature. You know, you don't rise up in Chicago South Side politics by being a radical leftist. You just don't know. That's Richard Daley's city. We were always very subordinate to Daley at the Urban League. So I had a good sense of who he was and his background. And then I happened to be in Iowa in 06 and 07 and early 08. So not only did I know him from Illinois and Chicago, we were getting inundated. And, you know, the political culture of Iowa is just insane. insane. We're just obsessed with presidential candidates here. And they all come through here. By the time of the rest of the country, it's winnowed down to two or three. There's like 80 of them. There's like 20 of them that come through here. And Obama was through here again and again, and I would sort of follow it. I was sort of interested in the... I mean, the only other place that might come close is New Hampshire, but Iowa's even worse. And I would follow these town halls, and I would start covering them a little bit. I would listen to Edwards, and I would listen to Dodd, and I listened to Obama. So I was really on the ground in an interesting kind of way. So not only did I think this guy was the next chief executive of the American Empire, my next book is going to be called Empire's New Clothes, and therefore right. an important historical figure. I was in an interesting situation with an interesting background to write about him. And my background also, my degree was in 20th century U.S. history. And I taught political history a lot in the past, back when I was in academia. So I don't know. It was kind of an accidental kind of thing. I would not have predicted it, but mm-hmm. there I was doing it. Yeah.
So Charnchi, if you want, go ahead and ask the next question.
Okay. Hi, Paul. This is Charnchi.
Okay, Charnchi.
How is the Obama administration different from prior Democratic administrations, do you feel?
Oh, I don't think it's particularly different in any particular dramatic kind of way from the Clinton administration or from the Jimmy Carter administration. There's a lot of parallels to the Carter administration. A lot of parallels between Obama and Clinton, between Obama and Carter, and between Obama and Kennedy. A lot of people want to make the LBJ parallel is real big right now because LBJ escalated a war in the mid-1960s that then undermined his war on poverty. And I get sort of tired of that metaphor after a while because Afghanistan and Vietnam are sort of very different types of wars. But maybe more to the point, although LBJ was really actually kind of sincerely starting to launch a war on poverty, which is the kind of thing that Obama isn't involved in at all. He's a corporate neoliberal. He's not particularly interested in wars on poverty. In fact, throughout his career, he's praised the vicious, regressive Clinton Gingrich welfare reform that was carried out in the 1990s. A little welfare elimination, really, the ending of the entitlement to family public cash assistance. So I think Obama's a lot more, in that sense, he's like Clinton in the sense they're both from the corporate neoliberal era. He's kind of like Carter in the sense that there's this kind of image of moral purity and having been from outside Washington. And as a guy who's supposed to provide a kind of moral rebranding of America's image at home and abroad in the wake of an awful, corrupt, terrible, nightmarish Republican administration. In Carter's case, it was in the wake of Nixon and Agnew. In Obama's case, it was in the wake, of course, of the whole Cheney-Bush fiasco.
So,
it's kind of like that. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you think the relationship of Obama is with the European elite? I mean, obviously, just recently when we saw the Obama accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, we saw a lot of European elites praising Obama. He obviously provides him with a better veneer for associating with the United States than, say, George Bush. So. Yeah,
right.
What do you see in that regard?
One of the interesting things, I think I've heard Chomsky say this as well. I've noticed this, and I've heard this from John Toger, who's I don't know if you've ever spoken to him, this wonderful left Australian and British commentator and journalist, who's very much in the Chomsky mode of analysis. Obamania is actually probably now, and has been for some time, more intense in Western Europe and more sort of out of control. It's receding a little overseas, as it has here as well. But it's probably crazier, actually. There's probably people who are more sort of naively, ridiculously, childishly gaga over Obama in Germany and in England and in the Netherlands and France and that. Apparently in Oslo, Norway, and people did the Nobel Prize. Than it is here. There was a very interesting piece in, I think it was The Nation. I'm not a big fan of The Nation, but there's some intelligent writing there every once in a while by people like, for example, Naomi Klein, and she had a piece a while back called Obama's Bad Influence. It was very interesting. It was about how Obama because of his popularity, was providing a kind of fake progressive pseudo-democratic cover for European elites to be more sort of grossly imperial in their own right. We sort of think of America as the only sort of aggressive nationalist imperial power, but God knows the Western Europeans have their own issues and their own nasty things they want to do. And so Obama was providing a certain type of cover for them to sort of beat their chest about the expansion of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, for them to commit, some of the elites to commit more troops to Afghanistan. And in her case, what Naomi Klein was writing about really being creepy about climate change and global warming, and essentially, I mean, it sounds like what Obama's emissary, I'm not following this very closely, but my sense is that the elites in the industrialized countries are actually sort of shredding or tearing up what was left of the Kyoto Accords in Copenhagen right now and over the next week or so. And Klein talked about a key meeting that took place in Bangkok, I think it was in October, where basically Obama administration and the Europeans together managed to gut any commitment to binding international carbon emission restrictions and to gut any fast and hard rules on carbon emissions for the very countries that have done the most to create the climate crisis, which is, of course, the advanced industrialized states. So that's kind of interesting. You know, it's not just Obama fooling Europeans into thinking he's more progressive than he is. We all know about his military policies, his corporate policies, but also providing them cover. A lot of leftists forget this in the United States because we get so hung up on how, you know, all the nasty stuff that we know Uncle Sam is doing in the world, and all the lousy social policy that is, you know, business dominated society that takes place here. And we forget that their class structures and aggressive and indifferent and mean spirited policies, domestic and foreign, in other advanced states.
Hey Paul, so I read through your book, and I mean you chronicle his rise from Chicago, and I thought the last two chapters of your book was really, really stood out to me and very interesting. And the next to last chapter, you talked about 16 reasons why Obama was basically chosen as the next president. And I went through the different reasons, and it kind of struck me, it's illustrative of two facts about the U.S. population. One is their level of depolarization. And the other is like
the level of right.
Yeah. And the other one is the strength of the doctrinal system. Can you comment a little bit about that?
Well, you know, one of the things, one of the interesting things, you talk about depoliticization. One of the interesting things, I go to public talks in Iowa or wherever, Chicago, Minnesota, and it's actually, I've been very irritated. And I'm biting my tongue a lot lately because a lot of progressives and left liberals who thought Obama was a peace candidate and thought he was a social justice candidate, you know, they're starting to fade a little bit, you know, because it's just too obvious how absurd the assumptions that they had about Obama were. I mean, my God, we had this Afghan escalation. We just had Obama go to Oslo to accept, of all things, the Nobel Peace Prize and then proceed to give a war speech for all intents. War speech to the American people in defiance of majority public opinion from West Point, what was that, last week, two Tuesdays ago, and so forth. So that's all kind of fading. So that's good. But the last year has, in Iowa, it all starts the year before. So 07 and 08, for a real leftist who knows the score on Obama, you know, like Chomsky knows, like Glenn Ford knows at Black Agenda Report, like Alexander Coburn knows at The Nation, well, Counterpunch, and so forth. It's been kind of irritating, but I go and give these talks and explain to people, I'm really not here to trash your candidate. That's really not the point. I think he's just a conventional mainstream politician. My main issue is actually how depoliticized a lot of you are, because I see you using Obama as an excuse to say, okay, we voted the right way and now things are going to be okay, and we can just go back to our private lives. And there's this definition of politics as being about nothing but these quadrennial, corporate-crafted, candidate-centered, narrow-spectrum, mass-marketed, Chomsky's phrase, electoral extravaganzas. Now, if people want to be confused about Obama, I mean, I guess that's their problem. And, you know, I wrote my book, and I wish they'd read it. They can get over that. But whoever they're for, whoever their candidate is, or whoever whatever their brand of choice is among politicians, you know, I wish they'd look at trying to construct a grassroots organizational everyday politics beneath and beyond these big melodramas we have every 4 years. I mean, it's like Chomsky says, you know, like, that's politics. That's the official line. So we get the small list of candidates that are vetted in advance by Wall Street and the military-industrial complex, and then we make this choice. Then we go back to our life. A lot of people, like in a town like Iowa City, and a lot of these campus towns are very dangerous because Obama is very, has this exaggerated kind of popularity among the academic class. Because he sounds intelligent, because he's highly educated. I'm sorry, you interrupted me?
I wanted to ask you if you're familiar with the work of Thomas Ferguson, and, you know, he's got this book.
Oh, The Investment Theory of Politics, right, yeah.
Right, and...
Yeah, but basically these candidates all represent different investment blocks.
Right, and what was interesting, because I did a documentary, I interviewed Ferguson and everything, was that, in fact, the reason why some of the earlier Democrats, you know, like Roosevelt and... you know, earlier in the century could be more progressive was because they were backed primarily by capital intensive industry and, you know, industry with fewer workers, and therefore they could come more easily to a compromise with labor, with a relatively weak labor movement. They could actually make some compromises because it wouldn't hurt them as much to
that
say
was the New Deal, right? That was the New Deal.
Raise the minimum wage or so. Right. So yeah, so but what I thought was interesting is that since the 1970s, the block that got stronger is the financial sector, and that financial sector was the one backing Obama, and
by far, yeah, he outraised McCain by 2-1 at least with Wall Street, and of course they set new records, and absolutely blew up what was left of the public presidential campaign finances, and that's older. Obama did that. You know, all along the way, claiming that he had what he referred to as a de facto public financing system, he claimed, because of all his small contributors. Actually, his campaign finance profile was every bit as plutocratic and as tilted towards big contributors, Wall Street contributors, insurance companies, and so forth.
Right, and
George Bush in 2004.
I don't know if you're aware, but one of the things that I was surprised to find out that Thomas Ferguson, you know, mentioned was that, you know, there was a lot of propaganda about the $200 or less contributions to the Obama campaign. But it turns out that a lot of those were simply, you know, they were breaking up the contributions and then contributing over and over again. So you had a lot of those were simply... Not really small contributions.
He must have gotten into the data to know that. That's because you really have to mine into the witch's exercise to do some of that. But good for him. That's important enough.
Yeah, it just seems that there's...
Well, they bundle them. You know, what a lot of the big law firms do is they call all their partners in, and they get, you know, like 20 of them at the really big firms, you know, to give $250 or, you know, $200 each. So, you know, technically small contributions because under 250, but it's adds up to you know, some factor of thousands from one law firm, and they make sure that the people in the Democratic Party know that this came from, you know, Smithers, Carruthers, and Street or whatever, you know.
So Paul, I actually asked this question to Chomsky, but I want to see what you think about it. When you see these crazy right wing attacks on Obama, probably racially oriented. Do you feel sometimes that the radical left should defend against that? And is that possible to do while maintaining a principled critique?
I never finished one thing. You said on the doctrinal system, I'll give you a good example with Obama. It's his repeated statements, both as a candidate and now as president, when he talks about the Iraq War. He has consistently handed out this line that we gave them a chance to create their future. That the invasion, that George Bush's invasion of Iraq, was motivated by noble and benevolent and democratic objectives. And we always are a good force in the world. This came out in his Afghan speech last week, and it was his Nobel speech. He can never, and never has once, admitted criminality or immorality or imperial motives behind U.S. foreign policy. And that is a perfect example of his enmeshment in the very same doctrinal system that George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, it was enmeshed. We're always good. I mean, his Nobel speech was just, you know, he got up there and accepted the Nobel speech and then defended war, telling all these people and all these Nobelians, and many of them sat on their hands and wouldn't applaud, that, you know, there's evil in the world. You know, and like most of the world thinks a lot of that evil is headquartered in Washington, D.C., and only other places. What I think is more to the point about the right-wing rage, I don't know if the way to fight it is to defend Obama. You obviously want to call them out when they're being racist. There's a bit of an overreaching on what passes for a left in this country sometimes to always call every assault on Obama from the right racist. I have some problems with that insofar as a lot of the crazy, and it's absolutely crazy, the crazy stuff is being said about Obama on the right. And you'll get a kind of liberal, he's in progressives for Obama, liberal lefty like Tim Wise will say, it all reduces completely 100% when they call him a socialist and a radical. It all reduces to racism. Well, if John Edwards was the president, or if Hillary Clinton was the president, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, and John Edwards and Hillary Clinton were and are white, would be screaming at the top of the lungs that these people are socialists. And in fact, in primary season, it was Hillary more than anyone else, it was totally, you know, absurdly called a radical and a socialist, you know, opposed to American military power. So they do that to all the Democrats, but you obviously want to call them out when they're clearly being racist and say that. You want to talk about the absurdity of the charge that Obama is a leftist. You know, he's bailing out Wall Street. He wouldn't do anything with a finger for the Employee Free Choice Act for workers' rights. If he was a leftist, he'd be trying to convert all these deindustrialized workers in Michigan who used to be in the auto industry who had their lives destroyed. He'd be trying to have a conversion program to get these people making light rail for ecological transportation systems in this country. I mean, you could just go down a million things that he's not doing that he would be doing if he was a leftist, and a bunch of stuff that he is doing that no leftist would ever do. So you certainly want to do that. I think Chomsky has said something else, too, which I agree with, which is that the left has been biting its, or, well, whatever we have in this country that passes for a left, has been biting its tongue too much. It's been too respectful. It's starting to change a little bit. And I've seen it change in very direct kinds of ways in the last couple of weeks. But the left has been too reluctant to articulate a principled and, you know, angry critique of Obama's conventional corporate imperial centrism. And the problem with that is that in that vacuum left by our sort of tendency to sort of passively line up behind Obama, there's a lot of legitimate rage out there in a country where 1 in 4 kids are on food stamps, 1% of the population owns 95% of the wealth, the official unemployment rate's blasting past 10%, which means the real ones at about 20%, and yet the government feels that it can send off 30,000 more troops at a cost of $1 million per soldier per year, as the schools are falling apart, as the infrastructure is run. So a lot of rage out there, and it's legitimate. You want to go around being angry all the time and beating your chest and yelling and screaming. And if there's nothing in the left that's articulating any anger, you can be damn sure that the right is going to articulate it, and they are. I mean, I recommend that people on the left listen, not too much, but in measured amounts. I get it when I'm in my car because I have nowhere else to go and I put my car radio. To Sean Hannity and to Rush Limbaugh and this insane right-wing lunatic Mark Levine and people like that. Now, I mean, they're completely out of their minds, but they articulate something that's out there, and they capture it in ways that too few people on the left. We need some hotheads in our own regard. The one nice thing in Iowa, and you only got to see it in Iowa, maybe a little bit in New Hampshire, about one of the Democratic candidates, Edwards, was this fighting message. And he used to say, I remember there was a presidential debate in Des Moines where Edwards and Obama, and Edwards had this really kind of, he was actually kind of an eloquent fellow. I mean, how much of it he meant, nobody really knows, and he's obviously a dubious type of character. I remember this one debate in Des Moines, he said, it's a fantasy to think you're going to get any kind of big progressive change except through an epic battle with concentrated wealth, you know, like guerrilla warfare. You have to fight these people. And Obama had this typical kind of corporate liberal / corporate neoliberal response. We don't need more heat. We need more light. You know, and everybody's invited to be at the table. Well, Edwards used to say, you know, if you invite the corporations to the negotiating table, they'll eat it. They eat everything. They devour everything. Well, look at the health reform, the so-called health reform. It's nothing but a gift to the big six insurance companies, to the Cignas and the Blue Cross Blue Shields. They're going to mandate that everyone has to buy insurance from them. They continue their parasitic vampire-like role, which is where we lose $400 million a year to their bureaucracy, which is dedicated to denying coverage, and to their through-the-roof profit rates. So, you know, there you go.
So I want to remind listeners that you can call in and ask Paul any questions you like. The number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. And we also welcome questions in the chat room. So, Paul, why is it that every time there's an election, large numbers of radicals dismiss the corporations backing the Democratic candidate and furthermore forget all the prior elections when they were proven wrong for doing so?
I don't know. I wish they would.
Said like the strength of the doctrinal system, or you know, are they just hoping that there's a way out?
Right. They're scared of the right. You know, it's not true that there are no differences at all between the Republican and the Democratic Party. I've written in the past about the two wings of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Party. I mean, it's a corporate imperial party system, and the doctrinal system is very narrow. But it doesn't mean there's absolutely no differences at all. There's a reason that the ruling class, though, wants two parties. They actually want to, and they always have, not just one. And this is what I try and when I get in debates with this town I live in. It's just loaded with know-it-all. I call them know-it-all, know-nothing academics who are in the Democratic Party. The ruling class, the corporate elite that hedges its bets by supporting both parties, needs another party. Always, another business party waiting in the wings for when the brand goes bad on the one that's in power. I personally think that all things considered, they tend to prefer to have the Republican Party in power because it's more explicitly and completely and openly favorable to business interests. And the Democratic Party, for various historical reasons, does have some constituency basis in the labor movement and the working class and urban minority populations, people who do have some redistributive demands and social needs and interests. So all things considered, the business elite would prefer to have the Republicans in, but they screw things up and they go over the top and they have their own problematic coalitions with far, far sort of right elements that aren't particularly sensitive to elite business agendas. And they screw things up like Nixon did in the late 60s and early 70s, and obviously like Bush and Cheney did. I mean, it was just an over-the-top messianic militarist administration that just gambled and lost and probably really did have an evangelical coup at the top of it.
You know, Paul?
And it was time to pull the brand from the shelf. It was time to pull that brand and bring out the other business party, and he scared the shit out of people. I mean, Bush really scared people. Michael Moore, you know, for example, was willing to be for Nader in 2000, but by 2004 he was just completely paralyzed at the fear of another Bush administration.
You know, I think it's interesting you say the thing about branding, because I mean, I personally think it's an extremely important factor that the business party definitely, you know, needs the, you know, to have a different sort of setup to deceive the population. But at the same time, I mean, one of the features of the investment theory is that the interest of the business class, you know, they are varied. I mean, they have a lot of interests in which they coincide. Of course, they'll, you know, respect for private property. They're not going to give you, you know, free labor unions, free healthcare and stuff. But there's some blocks of investors that are more in favor of, say, more free market. They're more in favor of certain policies. You know, they're maybe more capital intensive or more labor intensive, and the parties tend to align themselves, and different parties. I mean, the blocks of investors, they align themselves in different parties to. So yeah, I mean.
Well, you know, if you look at the campaign finance data in 2008, it's Obama really cleaned up on McCain, and the Democrats in general cleaned up on the Republicans in most of the leading sectors that tend to be reported in the data. But there's a few, I don't remember all of them, that still stay Republican even in this last election, and one of them was oil, and that has something to do with, I think, the culture of Texas to some extent.
Yeah,
or something. But they, yeah, and McCain, I think defense and oil. There may have been another, a few others, that the Republicans still maintain the dominant contribution levels on, but all the rest, and the ones that really matter in this financialized era, this post-industrial era, which are the finance, insurance, real estate, fire, you know, the analyst call, and that includes Wall Street. That really just leapt into Obama. You know, and quite frankly, the business elite and the imperial elite, I think, is getting away with things under Obama. They're going further with things. I think they've been able to go further with a whole bunch of policies, bullying Russia, rolling back the left in Latin America, maybe even Afghanistan, than I think they could have gone away with McCain. I think the corporate imperial calculation was right. This was their guy. Because there's this kind of cover. There's this fake progressive cover. Oh, he's a peace candidate. He's a social justice president. He used to be, you know, community organizer. You know, everyone forgets he went to Harvard Law, you know.
Right, right.
And had a private school education from junior high on and all that kind of stuff. You know, that, you know, and I'm not sure a Harvard Law grad isn't actually closer to the culture of, to the culture of Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And a graduate of the Naval Academy, which is what John McCain was at NASA.
So we have a few callers. So let's take the first one. Hello, can you identify yourself, please?
Hello?
Hello, yeah. What's your name?
My name is Jeff, and I'm calling from Kewaunee.
Hi. Do you have a question for Paul?
Yes, I do. Professor Street. I'm actually one of his old students. I was wondering if you could give me perhaps some observations you have, some comparisons between Reagan and his peace through strength mantra of the 80s and Obama's peace through war theme of the speech he gave on accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, which must have been quite a shock.
I'm not much of a Reagan expert, but I did take a look at Obama's speech, and you know the. Did you ever read 1984 by George Orwell?
Oh, absolutely.
War is peace, love is hate. I mean, I'm trying to find this here. I've got it somewhere in my pile. I found a headline on Obama's speech. Oh, a headline in Ohio calmly reported: Nobel-winning Obama defends war in call for peace. The speech I've been focusing on the most lately and writing about is actually the Afghan, the West Point war speech on behalf of escalation in Afghanistan that he gave two Tuesdays ago. I mean, and you know, if you listen to that speech, and you made all the voices neutral and just listened to the words. Somebody told you this was by George W. Bush. You could easily believe that. It could very easily have been George W. Bush. It's fascinating. This is what the rebranding is about. How these sorts of policies of escalation and these words to the effect that we're always on the side of freedom of the world, and we're always trying to export democracy in the world, and we are we are an overwhelming force for good in the world who never has to apologize for any of its actions. It's just bizarre, but it's why they want two parties instead of one, because they keep needing to rebrand it. Will cause liberals in university towns to frown when those policies and words emanate from a white Republican moron from West Texas, but somehow they become okay when they're associated with and the battle standard is being carried by, a sophisticated, urbane black Democrat from Chicago,
Well, I think I don't know if you coined the term, but you've used it often enough, the Empire's New Clothes. He is the perfect pitchman. He can have the same agenda as Bush, which is actually, the same agenda as previous administrations, something that's ongoing, something he alluded to in his speech in Afghanistan when he said he didn't really, he wanted to treat Afghanistan as something in a vacuum and not part of an ongoing, empire agenda. The thing is, you're right. We would not have, and I shouldn't say we, because obviously we're talking about this, but, the majority of Americans thought that that's what they would get with McCain. But they're willing to accept it if it comes from Obama because he is the perfect pitchman.
If you look at my book, Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics, this guy was vetted well in advance, of the keynote address that he gave in late July of 2004 at the Fleet Center in Boston. Because you remember, before that gives that address, he's in the middle of a Senate race, a U.S. Senate race in Illinois, which they think is going to be a tough race, and they find out it isn't going to be because of a sex scandal, the Republican opponent.
Right.
But when you go up for the U.S. Senate, you've got Hillary Clinton had him down to her mansion, and he met the top political lobbyists and money politics operatives down there on K Street in Washington. He was in New York, and he talked to these people. And they vetted this dude, and they threw questions at him, and he gave speeches, and he gave addresses, and all his answers were right out of Goldman Sachs, and they were right out of the Council of Foreign Relations. And it's a split-level discourse in America. There's one level of conversation that takes place between and among the power elite, and you can kind of read some of it in places like the Wall Street Journal and the business section of the New York Times. But they're very candid, because they know working-class people and ordinary people and poor minorities and so in urban populations aren't reading that so much, and they talk candidly amongst one another. And that was one level of discussion, which they found that he was completely okay. That Ken Silverstein wrote a wonderful article about this called Barack Obama Inc. In Harper's in November of 2006. They ran him through the ringer and said this guy is not, in fact, a starry idealist, but they loved him because all these kind of deluded liberal campus town sort of drunken yokels that I live around were convinced that he was one of them. And the fact that he was black and had an Islamic name was actually an asset. Crucially, critically, these were assets and perceived as such at the elite level because of the rebranding that they knew he was going to be needed to carry out, that he's going to need to carry out not only domestically but globally, and particularly in the Middle East, because of the Bush-Cheney madness in and around Iraq. And they loved it. And they looked at this guy, and, we never are fully privy to the conversations that they have. We can pick up as much as we can. But I am sure, that the conversations amongst the funders on more than one occasion, who better to be the public face of what they knew was going to be a massive bailout that was going to be required on Wall Street. And by the way, they knew that. Pam Martins has written about this before the full-blown meltdown in 08. They knew it. They knew it was coming. They knew it in 06 and 07. They knew they were over-leveraged and someone was going to have to pay for this stuff. They're looking for somebody Michelle Obama's just a master of playing that game of American politics of, on one hand, you know, the manipulation of populism by elitism, of, on one hand, sounding like a people's candidate and wrapping himself right. to the aura of, you know.
Okay, so I guess we can go to the next.
Right?
We can go to the next caller. Okay, thanks, Jeff. Okay, and we got Joey.
Hello.
Hello, Joey.
Jonathan, you there?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Hi there, Professor Street. I'm just. I'll just go ahead and give one question because I know we got some other callers and people. In the chat room also have some questions. But I was just wondering if you could, switching gears a little bit, speak a little bit to the crisis in the mainstream media right now. Right now we see, like, newspapers having problems with circulation and all these other types of, you know, economic issues. And we dealt with this earlier this week on our radio show. But I was just wondering if you can give us some of your thoughts, considering you're involved in the Z Project, about, you know, the crisis in the mainstream media, maybe how it opens up avenues for people in the alternative media, like stuff like ZNet, in our current environment, and maybe, you know, speak to, you know, what you think the future of something like ZNet or Democracy Now!, those types of things, would be in this situation.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, and there's some negative downsides. I remember the newspaper here in Iowa City is called the Press Citizen. It's a Gannett paper. Yeah, I think it's a Gannett paper. And I remember there's this guy in there, the opinion editor, and this was at the peak of the caucus thing here in Iowa in the campaign. And he's a left guy. He's an opinion editor. He had a job there. And he does this long interview with me about the reality of the Obama phenomenon. Which would have been very important to get out there in Iowa at that particular time, and it never runs. And I had a conversation with them later, and it never runs because they're having this huge layoff there, and, you know, like, half the people of the Citizen Press lost their job. He tried to keep his job, and it was a tough sell in a hugely democratic academic town like Iowa City. It was a little risky to put out there an interview with a radical. And so, you know, that just kind of got shot down because of the job fears. And I think that insofar as we're still depending on big papers for stuff, it's a problem. I mean, I know you're talking about how we need alternative sources. It bothers me that big city papers, I want alternative media, but I worry also about big city papers because I know this from Chicago. They're the only thing that really keep the tabs on daily. And I don't know, there's probably parallel things in Boston and New York, local newspapers, but the only thing then is just an enormous amount of corruption at the municipal level. And when you don't have those beat reporters around anymore that are looking at the corrupt contracts and the parking meter deals and the privatization deals and all that, civic democracy fades. Now, yeah, the upside is that we can boost alternative sources of media. I've gotten to the point that I almost feel like I don't need to rely. I almost don't need to read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal half the time. I have a topic, and I know Obama's given a speech or Hillary's done something with regard to Honduras or whatever, and I can just start going to, ZNet. It's amazing how much I rely on ZNet for basic kinds of stuff, and then find people who've read the Times that day and are linking those stories. I can turn over a book with just ridiculous rapidity nowadays, in part because we do have such extraordinary research capacities and get our story out there. And I can just find stories. So I think that's all well and good. I also think we need to look into the things that Bob McChesney and I guess John Nichols talk about in terms of media reform and break up a lot of the major media and create drastically expanded subsidies for alternative media so that we can fill that gap. There's a whole agenda about that that Bob writes about. And others doing a big supporter of that media. I mean, I've known so many people just burn out trying to have pirate radio stations and pirate blogs and so on and so forth. But we should also be lobbying and pushing, you know, for FCC changes and for funding changes and for policies to pour public money into this kind of stuff. You know, if we don't fill the gap, it's a real problem.
Cool. Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
All right. Thank you, Joey.
I'm sure I hit everything you were getting.
Yeah. thanks for being on with us.
Okay. So next caller here.
Hello.
What's your name? Hello. What's your name?
Hey, hello. Am I on air?
Yeah, you're on the air.
My name is Ron. I'm from Philadelphia. Mr. Street, I just wanted to ask you a question that has to do with what happens after Obama's popularity has faded away. Because I think that's inevitable. Because next year probably unemployment is going to be worse. The war is going to be dragging on. The fiscal crisis is going to be clearly, a problem. The next bubble is going to be bursting or whatever. And it seems to me that right now the only alternative...
It could be worse. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And right now it seems that the only alternative people have to Obama is the right wing. People like Palin and Rush Limbaugh. And I'm just wondering, what do you think is going to fill that void? And is this something that you think was done on purpose, or is it just going to be like an accidental side effect of all the Obama mania? Because to me it seems like the media has been very explicit in pushing Obama out there. And any idiot can see that eventually, he's kind of been set up to fail. That's why I feel hesitant to criticize Obama too much, because it's kind of sad to see what's happening. And in a year or two, he's going to be reviled. He's going to be hated because if things in this country don't improve, he's going to be scorned. And
You're saying something I think is very important. My publisher contacted me to do a second book about Obama's first year. I thought I was just going to do a new preface for a paperback edition of the book I did in LA. They said, no, do a... And I said, well, wait a minute, a second book with Obama in the title. One of the problems with that, I'm glad I did. I'm glad I ended up doing it. I always situate a politician in the business and the political, institutional system within which they operate. But, one of the problems, if you be careful about, is the elite does do this. They beat you to death with who the president is at that time. I mean, this was true when Bush was in, and it was true when Clinton was in. You just see these people 24/7 to the point that it just gets sickening. Now, among other things, it's kind of a diversion exercise. It just all becomes about Obama this and Obama that, or Bush this or Bush that, or Clinton this or Clinton that. And you get in the habit of that's all it's about, and you're not thinking about things like capitalism and imperialism and institutional racism, and interstate global systems and so on and so forth. And that can start to be a real problem. I do think that left criticism of the Democratic Party and of, Obama is deliberately rendered invisible in the media. It's amazing. I've actually been searching this a little bit, kind of with my Nexus, and looking at this narrative in the New York Times that the phrase Obama's critics or the Democratic Party's critics always means Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and the Republican Party. It's as if there's nothing whatsoever to the left of the Democratic Party. Alternative-wise, I don't know what that's going to be in 2012. Certainly things are looking up for the Republican Party. They should make a dent in the Democrats' majority in the midterms in 2010. We're waiting to see who on earth their candidate could possibly be in 2012. I just can't imagine them running Sarah Palin. I do think there is something to be said for having been set up to fail. You create this kind of messianic-like image around this guy, which is completely preposterous and which he could never fulfill. He's not God or something, and he is, after all, just a many ways a figurative, symbolic chief executive of American capitalism and imperialism, two systems that are in total crisis. So it is a scary situation in some ways, and I could see where someone would be somewhat inhibited about over-criticizing in that regard, given the narrow spectrum that we have and the lack of alternatives. On the other hand, I don't know how people are going to, on the left, enter the electoral system in any meaningful way if that's what they want to do, if they're too scared of doing anything that might feed the right wing. I'm not sure how different policy would be if we had McCain as opposed to Obama right now. And if there are any virtue, it's a complicated situation. If there are any virtue to having Republicans in this, at least it's no illusion. You know, sometimes I just want to throw up my hands and say, give me a right winger, because at least I know what I'm dealing with, because it's honest, that, you know. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling. So we have a few more questions in the chat room. There's about 4 minutes left. I don't know if you've heard about Greece, and there's been some anarchist revolts and stuff like that. This has been
in the anniversary of the previous year.
Right, and it's there's been some criticism from some libertarian socialists that, you know, maybe the movement would be more solid if it had more of a labor movement. Other people disagree, but what do you think the prospects are of movements in Europe providing a sort of a platform or inspiration for further struggles around the world and maybe in the United States?
Well, you know, it's there is this kind of electoral fascination and this kind of almost Stockholm syndrome-like attachment to messianic political characters over here, one thing I like that the Europeans do, and particularly the working class does, because they have a more autonomous and independent syndicalist tradition, and you know, when they find out that they're facing a job closure or an abandonment or a shutdown in plants, in various plants in France and England and Scotland and Ireland, they do like. We've only had really one of them in the United States in this recession, and that's in the Republic Door and Window Plant in Chicago. They occupy the damn plant. In fact, mm-hmm. in Europe, they call it Boston that thing. We need to learn from that. The American labor movement, the misleaders of the American working class, is overly attached to high-paid lobbyists in Washington, D.C. that are no competition for multinational capital at all in terms of influencing policy. If they think they're going to get the Employee Free Choice Act down there by hiring lobbyists, they can forget about it. The way they'll get it is with a wave of European-style Republican door and window occupations. They have to stop respecting private property to the extent that they do. And not just occupy plants. I think we ought to start thinking about some U.S.-style boss nappies. We need to keep some bosses around and make it clear
right.
They're not going home until people's jobs are guaranteed.
Right. Well, I guess that does it for the show. Thank you very much, listeners, and thank you very much, Paul Street, for joining us. And we recommend the listeners to read his books and keep up with his work. And keep up the good fight, Paul.
Thank you very much. We hope to have Empire's New Clothes out sometime in the middle of next year. The sooner the better.
And Paul, would you come back and talk about that with us?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. You bet. When it's out, we'll talk.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Okay, thank
good night,
you.
Paul.
Bye.
So that was Paul Street, and we're ending the show with Ay Carmela, a song from the Spanish Civil War, which you probably already heard before, but we like it. So good night, and thank you, Charnji. Thank you, everyone.
90 seconds.
Viva la quinta brigada, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Viva la quinta brigada, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Que nos cubrirá de gloria, ay Carmela, ay Carmela.